So, let us please continue, and we continue with the overview of the disclosure initiative, and changing from the agenda, I think we will take the last 15 minutes of this session when Malcolm will present a kind of introductions and for the breakout session. But before we doing that, I think I will hand over to the disclosure team and give us an overview of currently what we have done, because I think the breakout session is more or less than introducing what maybe some of you have already done, but really the question to you is, okay, is the disclosure initiative what we have done, do you think has contributed to that, or what we should do in addition? So I think it is good to, before we have that discussion in the breakout session, to give you a kind of overview what we have done and what we will do in the future under the topic of the disclosure initiative.
Thanks, Martin. So this session is primarily revolving around and the general overview or update as to where disclosure initiative is right now. And what we wanted to really emphasize was what the position of some of the projects within the disclosure initiative, because it's a multifaceted project with a lot of streams running parallel. And we wanted to put that into context and how the in a later part of this session we discussed the disclosure or drafting of disclosure requirements and how that fits into the overall disclosure initiative. So we have presented some slides. Slide 4 and 5 kind of gives an idea as to where we are. The project has within itself sub-projects which are in different stages of its life. We have some completed projects, and we very recently issued amendments to IS 7, and we've already completed IS 1, which was in 2014. Right now, there are a couple of projects in implementation arena, and then there's the research projects, one of which is the Principles of Disclosure project, and where we're expecting to issue a discussion paper in the next quarter. Most importantly, the drafting of disclosure requirements, which is the focal point of discussion today, is a part of this discussion paper that's going to come out. So that was where we wanted to focus your attention to. As you all might be aware, Principles of Disclosure project intends to identify and develop principles that would enable stakeholders when they're thinking about compiling financial statements in an overall sense. And because of that, it has several layers. And we thought to give a sense of those content that we're trying to discuss within the discussion paper and give you a listing of sort of an overall content of the discussion paper, which is in slide 6, and how each layer trickles down. So basically, the sections that we are going to discuss within the discussion paper is of mainly of three parts. The first one would be components of financial statements, where we discuss the distinction, the roles of each primary financial statement, and also a second layer, which would be the principles that we are discussing mainly about to improve the presentation and disclosure. And then finally, specific issues that we found and which we have highlighted throughout our outreach and board deliberations during the last couple of years. So within those specific issues, we finally can come to the drafting of disclosure requirement, which is an integral part, which the staff, the ISB staff, working alongside the New Zealand Standards have worked on for the last year or so. And this discussion is primarily about how we, as the organization, can think about redrafting disclosure requirements moving forward, what we need to think about when we are trying to issue new standards or amend the existing disclosure. So this is the main focal point of today's discussion, and without further ado, I'll hand over to Christy to take us through the next section, which would be Agenda Paper 3B.
Yeah, so this agenda paper, as Arjuna said, is about the drafting disclosure requirements. And in this presentation, I'll go through a summary of the approach we're taking. A bit about the work that we've already undertaken in that regard, some of the main features of that approach, and some possible outcomes, and how we can illustrate what that approach means. And then I've got some questions at the end. So if I move to slide 3, what we We will publish, as Arjuna said, the Principles of Disclosure discussion paper next quarter. Within that, we have included a discussion about alternative approaches we may take to drafting disclosure requirements. We want to get feedback on that, and obviously we'll get that feedback in that in the discussion paper process, but we felt we would use this session to get some initial feedback from you in order to feed into the responses we are wanting on those proposals. If I move to slide 4, I mean, why are we undertaking this work? And the reason is that we have heard that part of the causes the problems we hear about disclosures is actually the way we write our disclosure requirements. And therefore, we worked with the New Zealand Accounting Standards Board to develop a new way of thinking to how we might draft those disclosure requirements in standards going forward. And we're using the discussion paper as a vehicle to test and to see what people think of those proposals. So, as I mentioned, that those proposals were in the DP. So if I move to slide 5, so in terms of the work we've undertaken, we considered some of the work that's already gone in the conceptual framework project at the moment, in particularly the section around presentation and disclosure, and there's discussion there about what should be included and what the board should think about when setting standards. And also some of the discussions in the Principles of Disclosure project more broadly around objectives and roles of the notes in the primary financial statements. I'd also note that during the process of developing these proposals, we spoke to a number of national standard setters to get their view about how those requirements might look and whether they were supportive. And actually, I think initial responses have been positive. We, taking that on board, we looked at two standards to test the way we draft. So those were IAS 16 and IFRS 3. Now, we've included some examples from IAS 16 in this presentation. What I want to really highlight is what we're testing there is the way we draft, and the content is something that is not really what we're looking for feedback on. It's actually the use of the words and the way we lead into the objectives and describe the objectives rather than the objectives themselves. If I move to slide 6, so what are the main features of this approach? First of all, it includes an overall disclosure objective in each standard, and then more specific objectives or lead-ins to the actual requirements themselves. So trying to give a bit more information about why the information that's being requested is going to be useful to users. There is a proposal that there needs to be a greater reminder that a preparer needs to use exercise judgment when assessing those disclosure objectives and requirements. And in order to enable that, one of the proposals is that the disclosure requirements should be through a two-tier approach that leads a preparer or somebody using those disclosure requirements through that judgment process. So the first tier would be a summary, a requirement for summary information, and that's where you'd expect most entities who for which that topic is pertinent to make that sort of disclosure. And then the second tier is where that topic is very important or key to that entity, you'd be expecting to make more disclosures. So for example, if you're an industrial company, you may only make the summary disclosures about financial instruments, but then if you're a financial institution, you're expected to perhaps look at the full suite of the disclosure requirements. The final point here on this slide is that it's based on the types of information, which are a description of the type of information that would be expected to be seen in the notes, and that's discussed elsewhere in the discussion paper. So if I move to slide 7, what are the possible outcomes of the proposed approach? I think ultimately its purpose is trying to get people to use judgment, or enable actually people to use judgment about materiality when looking at a set of disclosure requirements. the amount that could be disclosed could be less, but realistically what we're trying to do is provide more detail so that an entity can decide, can understand why the information is needed and therefore able to assess whether the requirements are necessary or actually are other requirements more reasonable. In terms of the proposed approach itself, if I move to slide 8, this sort of sets out some of the proposals and using IS-16 as an example. So in terms of the overall disclosure objective, slide 8 sets out the possible objective that could be included in IS-16 to reflect what we're proposing. And then in terms of how that then might be brought down into a series of more specific disclosure requirements, the objectives that might set the scene for those more specific requirements is in the second paragraph on slide 8. So it's really, again, just giving more and more information about why that information is useful and therefore enabling somebody reading those disclosure requirements to make a judgment about materiality in that context. Shall I finish the slides? The next slide, 9, talks about the proposed language on the need for judgment. So again, that reminder that judgment is necessary to assess what disclosure requirements you need to make in order to meet the objectives as described. And here we've included on slide 9 a possible reminder. Now, there's a question whether this needs to be in every standard or can be in the central standard. If I move to slide 10, here we talk about the summary disclosure that's required and is linked to the overall disclosure objective could be, again, the way, you know, I mentioned that one of the proposals is to lead an entity through what could be the sort of the basic disclosure requirements for most entities before they get into the more detailed disclosure requirements. And slide 10 gives you an example in IS-16 about what could be that disclosure requirement at that high summary level that you would expect most entities to provide. And then finally, if I move to slide 11, this is where you'd have the additional disclosures, so the more detailed disclosures, and gives you an example of how those might be drafted. And I think this specific example relates to measurement bases and related uncertainties. I think one of the key things to draw out here is that we struggled with was how to describe the requirement we've set it here, an entity shall consider whether to disclose. And that phrase has caused us quite a bit of debate because it's trying to replace what's in standards at the moment, which sometimes goes along the lines of an entity shall disclose A, B, C, D, or at a minimum an entity shall disclose X, Y, Z. So it's trying to be indicating the use of judgment again in the way that we've drafted that lead in to what is a disclosure requirement. Then, so if I move to slide 12, and this sort of sets out the key messages that I have for today, which is question 1, do you consider this is helpful to include in each standard an overall disclosure objective and more specific objectives related to the group of disclosures? Do you think it's helpful to have a reminder about the exercise of judgment in each standard, or would you prefer that in a general standard, or not at all? And then finally, do you think it's helpful to split disclosures between the summary information, so what you'd expect nearly all entities, if they have that particular topic to disclose, versus those for which that topic might be of key importance? So those are the three questions we were asking today, but I think if you have any responses to that, but also if you have any other questions, please.
Okay, thanks, Christine. First, Sandra.
As I went through this, I felt that some of the language could be a little bit more straightforward. And then in the one section where you use the terminology required to consider, sometimes you don't even need to go and consider, and I think with having that language Your auditors are going to be looking for documentation even on things that just from the beginning are immaterial. So it can drive incremental work that's not value added. So just an observation. And then when you're looking at PP&E, significant measurement uncertainties, I wasn't clear what that related to, if you were looking at the initial measurement of PP&E and some of the uncertainties associated, for example, if you had an acquisition, or does it mean your measurement uncertainties associated with the depreciable lives and things like that? So it was a little bit unclear what direction you expected the preparers to go.
Yeah, I you know, don't get too caught up in what the actual requirement is saying. It's more how's it drafted rather than, you know, this is not a proposal to amend I-16 in this way.
Yeah,
this is to illustrate.
Yeah, but it highlights when you use terminology like that, mm-hmm. you need to think about what the preparers are going to be thinking about. Are they going to be thinking about the amortization? Are they going to think about initial measurement? Where else could you potentially have measurement uncertainty? And just be very careful when you use the term shall, because it will drive the auditors to have a certain expectation, and there should be judgment applied before you know, get into that.
But Sandra, are you okay with the general direction of travel, though, you know, a very summary, limited amount of required and required to consider, you know, everything else that's on the list? Are you okay with the philosophical direction of it?
The philosophical direction I'm okay with, although I think we've always been comfortable internally applying judgment on which types of disclosures were not relevant and not including those. And I do question whether or not it's truly needed to go into something like this, and it seems like a lot of work where you might be able to achieve something similar with something that's a little bit more straightforward. You know, just an observation, you know, companies have to exercise judgment, and you know, perhaps it's more in the dialogue between the auditors and preparers, or the auditors and regulators, on where to draw the line and in applying judgments.
Can I just ask you two questions on that? First, you mentioned something more straightforward. What would you have in mind?
Yeah, you know, every time I read something, I always think about if I had to turn around and explain it to somebody that English isn't their first language, and trying to justify why we headquarters are asking for something. I don't know if I could just, you know, if I could come up with a more simple statement, but that's when we write our guidance, and we sit there and talk about, you know, would somebody in China be able to understand this language, and you know, you have more sophisticated accountants that are going to be reading this, and you have people that may not have had the breadth of experience to be able to interpret and make those judgments, and I think the more simply you state it, the better outcome you'll have of people understanding what exactly is being asked.
And then just one other question. I think you've got some concerns that shall to consider language. And as I said, we've spent some time working, trying to consider alternatives to that. Would you be comfortable, from what you said, with just keeping you shall disclose? With the caveats that, you know, you do use judgment, and so don't read shall. You know, shall is subject to materiality.
I think, if I recall, there was a section in here on sort of overarching, you only do this if it's material. I would have been comfortable in the base case applying judgment, but not every company and not every auditor will respect that the way that I think it should be respected.
And I found that difficult because I really think, because my understanding is, okay, many people have told us, okay, that this maybe disclosure overload is driven by, we have drafted the standards, you should disclose at minimum and then have a list of 1,000 items, and without judgment they then report all these items. And to change that, I think only way is then to say, okay, not to have, say, at minimum, that is to should consider and then give some kind of examples. And clearly that needs clearly from the preparer side then judgment on their side. And I agree it is maybe easier for a company to have this checklist approach and summarize all the information then from the subsidiaries, pack them and then report them. It is from the process I think easier because it doesn't need any judgment. But I don't find a middle way regarding, I think that is then, I think maybe in the headquarters you have then when you need your reporting package as a preparer and collect all the information and then makes this judgment call at the headquarters and saying, okay, is it material or not, or is it important information or not? But I think from our perspective, man, how we should draft standards, I think that is, if we want to address it and if that is a problem, we can debate that. But if I find it difficult to find another way how to do that.
I don't know if it's more a dialogue with the auditors or the from that perspective, but sometimes I look at efforts and say, is it going to cause more problems or be more helpful?
When I agree, it is. I think we think, okay, it is overall a change in behavior from auditors, right, from regulators, from preparers, and there is not one thing which we can do, okay, that change the whole thing. It is maybe several steps, and we think that maybe this is one step that we can do, but clearly, if then the behavior of others is not changing, that is not very helpful.
And the other thing is, in terms of context, we have given other tools that could help this judgment. So there is a statement in IS1 that says you do not need to provide information related to a disclosure requirement if that information is not material. There is a clear statement in IS1 that is there. And we've also got the draft practice statement in materiality. So we've already given some tools. This is asking, should we do more?
Yeah. Bob?
I like where you're headed. I think it's good. As Martin said, there's only so much you can do. And as in this previous slide, as Martin said, in one of the previous slides at the bottom is behavioral change. And that means all involved need to change their behavior, and there's only so much you can do. And I think this is a good start and the way to do it from your perspective. I'm not sure if there's much more you can do. I would agree with Sandra. The word shall, it's got so much baggage with it, you may just want to avoid using it. I don't know if you go through the thesaurus and see a similar word. I'm not sure if should qualifies, but shall's got so much baggage, you may just want to avoid it. To your questions, though, says, like I said, number one, I agree with what you're doing, and I think we kind of a similar question with number three, and I think it's really good work. On number two, your question, do you consider it helpful, more emphasis on judgment? I personally don't. We're supposed to be professionals. Sometimes we don't act like it, but I don't think it's helpful. But I, and I'm not trying to put words in Sandra's mouth, is that we got to change our behavior, and so I wouldn't go much deeper into what the auditors would think or what we have to do with our people that don't understand English. And this is not exactly what you were saying, but I'm not sure if there's much further you guys can go. It's behavioral change. You've worked hard to try and do your part. I think it's now our part. It's the regulator's part, and it's the auditor's part. And I think you guys have probably been out in front, standards have been out in front in behavioral change versus the rest of us, which have been kicking and screaming to change our behavior. So just in summary, I really like what you're doing. I think it's hit the right spot. I'd be careful going into too much more detail. You got to be really understand what users want. And we always discuss what the right users are and things like that. But They're first and foremost, and there's going to be, I think, concern with disclosure overload needs less disclosures. And just to get a real side point about materiality, if we get into that, I think people are chasing their tail on materiality. I know what's material. If I'm discussing it at Microsoft, it's material. I wouldn't be discussing it. And it may not be I want to disclose it, but it's material. And, you know, I think the users, especially where materiality has gone to U.S. under the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and I don't have the exact words, but I think it is, if the absence of this information would have had an impact on your investment decision, just getting back to my previous points, with the colossal amount of gobbledygook that we put out there, I could probably put the disclosures down to one page. It's a bunch of gobbledygook. What I'm not disclosing is the important information, like intellectual capital and human capital. So I think you have to be real careful with the users, especially with materiality, and I think they have a point in that how above board, and I'll be self-critical, have we as preparers operated in being transparent? And so I think you need to consider that, but I think you're doing a really good job. I don't think there's much more you can do, actually.
Okay, Christoph?
I can echo Bob's comment that I think you're doing the right thing. Although I agree it's only a small stone in a pretty large building, but that you cannot add more than that small stone. I like the idea about the disclosure objectives, but I think they need to be useful. If it is a very generic thing like disclosures about PPE are supposed to provide additional information about PPE, that's not useful. And I found the examples you had a little bit light in that respect. So if you really want to give them an importance, the objective, then there needs to be more than a generic statement that everyone would agree with, and that wouldn't provide anyone with more information than he could think of himself.
Yeah. I just in response, I know that the New Zealand staff who drafted this again struggled with the disclosures and the objectives. And one, it highlighted actually it's very difficult to write a very good objective that really sort of hones in on what's useful, but also that you really need to be reconsidering the recognition of measurements and the standard as a whole. So it sort of highlighted some of the limitations of using I-16 as an example to draft without really going into what you're trying to achieve in the project as a whole. So. Just to echo that it's something that we're okay. Cognizant of.
About emphasizing the judgment, I think that's important. I would wish a little bit more of flesh to the bones by highlighting things like, don't worry about hindsight. You make the judgments at the time you make the disclosures, and others may come with hindsight, but that isn't so. Planning for hindsight is something you shouldn't do when making the disclosures, and you should think about the world as it currently stands, because oftentimes we think about whether to make a disclosure, and give an example, if it's about currencies, you say, well, if currencies move less than 10-15%, nobody would be interested in that disclosure. If currencies move 30-40%, people may be interested in that disclosure. Now, what do you do? Do you say, well, because I cannot exclude currency movement of 30%, I put the disclosure in? Or do you say, well, I currently don't observe more than 10% of currency movement, so I don't put it in? So that's what I mean by a little bit more flesh to the bones that helps people make the judgment, and that helps people defend themselves against regulators and others that may look at the disclosures with hindsight. I struggled a little bit with the where to draw the line between the summary disclosures and the additional disclosures. Because I thought about, all right, what should be driving me to determine whether I need to make the minimum disclosures? It's materiality. And what do I need to consider when thinking about the additional disclosures? Materiality. So that's why I thought, well, if the consideration for both are the same, where do I draw the line? And I don't think we want to draw the line in a way of the minimum disclosures you make regardless of whether they are material. I think we all agree they should only be made of material. Last comment, some of the wording sounded a little bit like, let's call it a relative materiality. So to give you an example, we've got about 2 million of inventories in a 40 billion balance sheet. because inventory is not really something for a software company. I have policies that impact significantly the 2 million and that may move it from 2 million to 2.5 or 1.5. Yeah, so on a relative level, yes, there are policies that are important for that position, inventories. But inventories overall is of no importance whatsoever. So, and that's where the wording, as it's currently worded, it looks a little bit like, is it important for the topic? But if the overall topic is completely irrelevant, I wouldn't talk about it even if I had a policy that was important to that immaterial topic. But that's more how it sounds when reading it. That was it.
Okay, thanks, Christoph. Kevin?
Several things. Where you can go for drafting in order to tone the words, I know you don't want to get to free-form disclosures, but I think that's where we could end up in 20 years' time. But maybe take some of your wording to the Financial Reporting Council in the UK or the IASB. You know, they've moved to long-form audit reporting, and the long-form audit reporting have actually become useful. And there was nothing very specific in there. There was a lot of free choice in what the auditor could include and what was relevant. And that's what we're trying to get to, is relevant and reliable financial reporting without the shalls and the shoulds and the must and the cans. And it seems to be a successful process. The Americans are still going to evolve into it, but the rest of us have managed to evolve through that process, and it's become a useful document. So there is a way to get the drafting done. I think because you're running a discussion paper, because people do not necessarily, outside of their comfort zone, be absolutely honest, it might be an opportunity during your outreach process to actually sit down with just the Big Four or Big Six or whatever it is and say, how do you interpret this and what would you make your client's document? Then go to the audit regulator. What would you expect in an audit file if this was in the accounting standard? Act as the arbitrator through the discussion process in order to get wording that this looks like we will get an objective. Someone's got to act as that arbitrator, because as the preparer, our avoidance is restatement. And our other avoidance is the auditor being criticized and having to withdraw his opinion. And so we're caught in the middle between a rock and a hard place. So we can push the boundary, but we have to protect an end result as well. And there is a process in which the words can be done. And I'll just, one of the things that we're toying with at AngloGold now is that we think, as a global operation in a country that does not have worldwide tax, that the tax rate reconciliation is the most irrelevant disclosure that we have. So we're toying with the idea of having a tax rate reconciliation per segment reconciling to the group tax position, because we think that's much more relevant information to a user if our segments are changing dramatically when we have multi-tax in multi-tax jurisdictions. So this gives me the opportunity to go there. The auditors are getting horrendous, but I think that's the right answer. Even though it's out there left field, I think it's the right answer where you've got to go. You like the South Africa.
Very intrigued. Yeah. Leaders again.
Peter?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on that suggestion of Kevin's about the tax reconciliation, because a related question came up when we put that reconciliation in. And the question was, do you use the parent company rate or some sort of blend for the group, or what do you do? And what we were told by the user at the time was that the absolute rate that was used in the reconciliation actually isn't important, but what they were interested in was the reconciling items per se. And so that's why we didn't specify which rate to use. We wanted to make sure people concentrated on the reconciliation. So the idea of sort of splitting it down into segments or some other smaller group is actually probably quite consistent with that idea. Now whether that's consistent with the standard as it's worded is obviously another question. But it might be worth pursuing that thought.
Well, even when you do the blend, all those recon items get lost. Yeah. You know, I'm in 20 countries where none of the tax rates are consistent. It's a mishmash.
Any other comments? Frank?
I agree with Bob. I don't think we should try to overemphasize judgment. We know judgment's there, and that's why companies in the past have been burnt, because it's equally able for someone else, like a regulator, to take a different judgment on qualitative narrative issues. I think something like accounting policies, you could make a real change if you said you need to be disclosing things that are more company specific. So a lot of those accounting policies become very generic and just a repeat of the standard. If you get them to focus on what's your company specific policies, you're going to draw out information today that they don't even disclose. But I do think, you know, making more concrete examples is the way forward, because preparers, at least in Australia, are looking for more concrete basis to move forward, because they've been burnt in the past of trying to attempt to remove things, and it's been overturned.
So when you say concrete examples for us to provide actual examples of things that you could amend, so I'm just trying to work out what you mean by concrete examples.
It's hard because you're doing this in the context of a group set of accounts, but there may be a particular business segment that when you do a subsidiary account, those disclosures are absolutely relevant. So it might be, for example, a life business, but that life business is consolidated into a larger financial services where life is a small component. So you may see at the group accounts that life stuff should not be disclosed because it's immaterial in the context of the group. But there have been examples where people have been forced to bring that up in the group because you did it in the subsidiary level.
Kevin?
Sorry, just on what Frank was saying. So there's one huge gain that you can put in. For group subsidiaries, where we have statutory reporting requirements for the underlying subs as well, that as the holding company is the provider of capital, some type of allowance that the providers can exempt disclosures but still be in compliance with the disclosure of the principals, so that I don't have 50-page financials on my 100% subsidiaries that I'm the only one that uses them. That would assist in cost-cutting throughout the world, because that's where we waste lots of time and lots of cost. It's growing huge audit fees for irrelevant data.
What would you have us do, Kevin?
Some type of an allowance that provides the users, the providers of capital, as that's already been divided, to dispense as a resolution that appears then in the statutories, the shareholders have resolved that no disclosures are necessary on the following balance sheet items. Because it's the same shareholders who are approving my financials.
But a lot of that's statutorily driven, you know, they want to, you know.
Well, let's say, in South Africa, our statute says our financial statements must comply with IFRS. So if my shareholders can exempt something, then I'm in compliance, if the standards permit it.
Kevin,
this idea was
it's in the subsidiaries, not in the holding.
But this idea,
how would you protect minority shareholders?
Well, then I'm not a subsidiary, so then I haven't got the declaration.
Are you only thinking about the 100% subsidiaries?
My 100% subsidiaries are buying huge costs.
So you would ask for a 100% shareholder vote,
yes,
on such decisions?
Yes.
There's also some feedback in the gender consultation where some propose that we maybe come up with a kind of standard, which is then for this kind of subsidiaries, which are 100% and fully applies in the IFRS's recognition and measurement, but then have a reduced disclosure.
Yeah.
If that is SME or something different, I think that is the same
even
idea.
Less than SME.
If you think if the purpose is only limited, why asking to do all this kind of disclosure, which nobody is reading? And I think we will consider it when we, because as there was some voices in the gender consultation proposing that.
Can I just check I understand Kevin's proposal, because we have heard it, and I think we've discussed it in this group before, actually, or it's been raised in this group before. So if I understand it, your subsidiary might be able to use the IFRS for SMEs, but you prefer not to because it's different recognition and measurement from full IFRS. Is that the situation?
I don't even want to do IFRS for SMEs. I don't mind applying my regular IFRS accounting policies that I have in the group, but 50 pages of disclosures where I just prepare it to get an audit opinion to put in my bottom drawer is a waste of money. I want to be able to have heavily abbreviated disclosures, in fact, if necessary, none, just the 5 primary financials and no disclosures, but because that's all I need to comply with IFRS to get an audit opinion.
In the group accounts?
In the subsidiary.
Oh, in the separate.
100% subsidiary. You will save fortunes in group audit fees.
Will not, I think, be a good solution, because then you have to do different recognition and measurement.
That's right.
I said
yeah.
To Peter's question, I'm a little embarrassed to say it, but I don't even know if I can use the SME standard for statutory reporting. I guess what I'm just saying, maybe other multinationals aren't facing this, but it is such a mess and such a horrific waste of resources, the statutory reporting aspects for multinational. And I'll just admit, we don't have a great handle on it. My personal comment, not commenting for the company, is great question. And we haven't even asked it, you know, it's we kind of outsource all that stuff. So that's kind of what you're running into. You know, you could suggest making this new third thing, but would companies use it? I don't know. So.
Stephen as in Stefan.
Just on Kevin's point, I agree that we should look at that. I think we shouldn't jump into anything because of creditors as well as equity investors, but I do think it's an area we should look into. But that wasn't the reason I put my card up. Is this wording of shall consider? If we imagine for a second a world where materiality is applied properly, so everybody does it, everybody understands it, the auditors are on board, the regulators are on board, everybody does what they think they should be doing on materiality. My question to you is, in that hypothetical world, would we ever need to change any of our disclosure requirements? Or would the proper application of materiality solve all of your issues?
Well, hard to say black and white, but I would tend to agree if we all parties involved in financial reporting act as professionals and actually did what the standards say and apply things materially, and that's a given, even though it says you shall do this, if we all acted like professionals and acted properly, I don't think you'd have to do anything.
My concern is that we're thinking of changes that are in the wrong direction. We shouldn't be making the changes to shall consider and these objectives and everything, and it's all unnecessary because the real problem is materiality.
Well, but, you know, I don't know if the real problem is not the in my mind, the definition of materiality. The problem is professionals, everyone involved is the application of materiality, and I don't think you can come out and try and define it and that will solve all our problems. It's a behavioral change, but I'm skeptical of the players in financial reporting changing their behavior all that much. So to do nothing is to do nothing. You got to do something. And so I agree with you theoretically that we should be all acting as professionals. We don't. I don't think it's changing soon. And I'd like you to do at least something, and maybe we can do something too. But not doing anything is just going to not going to go away.
Could doing something tip us the opposite direction? So shall consider, what about, I think, Sandra, you mentioned not all companies will respect the change.
Right, and I think your question is a much more articulate way of what I was trying to raise, that you may not have to do all these projects if you work the underlying issue, which is, you know, building up that respect for companies applying materiality and judgment in the existing disclosures that are out there.
Yeah, but
I'm not sure, you know, how you go about doing it. I think you've got to get the stakeholders together, because many companies are comfortable applying judgments and making a determination on what's relevant for financial statements. Where you end up with issues, I know we've added in some disclosures over the years, and, you know, because the regulator said, you know, we want this in there, we've added it in, and then it's on a list that it doesn't ever come out because, you know, the regulator asked for it. And, you know, it's changing the mindset of the other parties and preparers as well on applying materiality and judgment.
I don't know. You know, you're not saying this, Sandra, but we as preparers are in an agency position. We're agent of shareholders, but by being as agent of shareholders, we have human emotions where, quite frankly, we like to make ourselves look good and line our pockets, to be quite honest. And so I think we need to change as much as anyone. And you didn't say this, but, oh, let's just allow companies to do judgment. I'd be worried, quite frankly. I think everyone needs to, but it's a underlining change in everyone acting differently. What I'm trying to say is I think we need to be, as preparers, our goal as accountants is to be transparent. It may not make the company look good. In the long run, it's the right thing to do. Academic studies have shown clearly that transparency lowers the cost of capital over time, although we in the preparer community some reason don't believe it and believe it's a grand conspiracy. Because that's because we don't like to get criticized ourselves. But quite frankly, we need a change. It would be, I think, the most, in my mind, striking thing that should change. If anything, it's the way preparers act with respect to transparency in the capital markets.
Sorry, in the interest of time, I think, but we can continue really this kind of discussion after the breakout session. So I will give now Malcolm this 10-15 minutes to really introduce the session this afternoon, the breakout session.